You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks, and this is the Columbia Calling podcast with me, your host, Richard McCall, episode 346. A big episode for us this week on the Columbia Calling podcast, as our very special guest will be on the line from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And you'll know him, of course you will, from the book One River and the latest book, Magdalena River of Dreams, Wade Davis. He'll be on in the third segment talking to us about Columbia in general and, of course, his new book, Magdalena. And it's an absolute honor for us to have him on this show discussing Columbia and discussing, actually, some mutual friends that we have and his thoughts on everything Columbia. I'd like to read a couple of quotes from the book just to get you sort of primed for what is coming up. But one of the quotes that stuck with me is, "Columbia is today at a crossroads, a country emerging from 50 years of conflict, eager to tell all who will listen that it is not a place of violence and war, but a land with a vast and rich natural heritage unrivaled in all the Americas." And then, "Were Colombians to devote even a small quota of their limitless energy and capital to the revitalization of the Magdalena, imagine the message they would send. A river reborn at a time when the world may be falling apart, but Colombia is falling together." So pretty epic quotes there, pretty epic quotes from Wade Davis's most recent book on the Magdalena. This week we have some advertising for you, and I just want to say that thank you to those of you who made this possible. And this advertising is the following. Calling all U.S. citizens, your vote counts. Even if you have never lived in the U.S. or haven't lived there recently, go to votefromabroad.org. That's votefromabroad.org today to request your ballot. Votes received from abroad make the difference in elections every year. If you have voting-related questions, you can use the red chat box on votefromabroad.org and someone will get back to you within a few hours. Don't delay. 15 states have already passed their registration deadlines. See if you are still eligible to register and request your ballot today. Thank you again for the sponsors. Please stay tuned. We'll be back with Emily Hart in the newscast and then Wade Davis on this episode 346 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Don't go away.
I'm Emily Hart and this is the news for Columbia Calling for the week of October 12th, 2020. After 2 months of house arrest under investigation for witness tampering and bribery, former President Alvaro Uribe is to be released after a ruling on Saturday. After he resigned from the Senate, the case was transferred from the Supreme Court to ordinary justice, and it has now been ruled that with the change of court, the original order for house arrest is no longer valid. In September 2011, Senator Iván Cepeda produced testimonies that Uribe and his brother had participated in the creation of the Metro Bloc, part of paramilitary group United Self-Defense Forces. Uribe accused Cepeda of fabricating evidence. In 2018, a court concluded that Cepeda was not just innocent, but instead the victim of Uribe himself, who had used fabricated witness testimonies to back up his own accusations. Uribe's trial is ongoing. Senator Cepeda will be appealing the judge's decision to let Uribe go free, while US President Donald Trump tweeted in support of Uribe's release, calling him a hero. The Uribe investigation has birthed numerous other legal issues. Prosecutor Montealegre has asked that the judge investigate current President Iván Duque for undue investigation and injustice after his public pronouncements on the case. Weekly magazine Semana have also come under legal fire for publishing documents relating to the trial. A controversial ruling this week ordered the magazine to remove its article on the subject, and two of its journalists could be investigated for violating the confidentiality of the trial. Another massacre has occurred this week in Khamundi, in the Valle del Cauca. This makes 67 massacres in Colombia in 2020 and 3 in Valle del Cauca. An indigenous Minga, a social protest, began this week, meeting in Caldono and marching to Cali to meet with the president. The demonstration is demanding action in response to the recent massacres and assassinations of social leaders, as well as the presence of armed groups in indigenous territories. Unlike traditional Mingas, there will be no roadblocks due to the pandemic. If Duque does not arrive in Cali, the indigenous people plan to continue their caravan to Bogotá. This week, the World Bank released estimates that the GDP of Colombia will fall by more than 7% in 2020, and that the economy will grow by 4.5% in 2021. These estimates are less optimistic than the Colombian government's own, which calculated 5% GDP drop and 6% economic growth next year. That was the week's newscast, and now a message from our sponsors. Calling all US citizens, your vote counts, even if you've never lived in the US or haven't lived there recently. Go to votefromabroad.org today to request your ballot. Votes received from abroad make the difference in elections every year. If you have voting-related questions, you can use the red chat box on votefromabroad.org and someone will get back to you within a few hours. Don't delay. 15 states have already passed their registration deadlines. See if you're still eligible to register and request your ballot today. Now back to Columbia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is the Columbia Calling podcast, episode 346, and I'm really pleased and quite honored to announce that our guest this week is Wade Davis, the author of 20 books, including One River, The Wayfinders, and Into the Silence. That one won the 2012 Samuel Johnson Prize, the top British award for literary nonfiction in the English language. He was the explorer in residence for over a decade for the National Geographic Society, and he's currently the professor of Anthropology at the University of British Columbia. 2016, he was made a member of the Order of Canada. In 2018, he became an honorary citizen of Columbia. And this year, his book, Magdalena River of Dreams, came out. And that is, of course, what is of interest to hear us here on the Columbia Calling podcast. So can I just say thank you so much for your limited time and agreeing to be on my little podcast.
Oh, Richard, it's a joy to be with you. I just love what you've managed to do in Mompos, and it's just fun to meet you, mate.
Yeah, thanks. So you're talking to us right now from Vancouver, so a long way from where I am right now in Mompos, and I hope that the ambient noise behind us in Mompos doesn't interrupt too much. But I just want to, let's talk about how this book came about. It was like a throwaway conversation in Medellin one afternoon.
Yeah, well, I was very lucky that some really extraordinary journalists from Medellin, Hector Rincon and Ana Cano, who had worked out an arrangement with the Grupo Argos, where they were producing a series of books, illustrated sort of coffee table books, on all the five major regions of Colombia, La Costa, Los Llanos, Amazonas, La Cordillera Central, I mean, the Cordillera and the Chocó. And these books were not to be sold as much as gifted to every library in the country to send a message to a new generation of Colombians that, of course, theirs was not a country of violence and conflict, but rather a place of the greatest biodiversity, ecological and geographical diversity on the planet. And they had asked me to come down to help promote the Amazon edition of the series. And just one day over lunch, I sort of said, you know, well, now that you've covered the land, why don't we do the rivers? And in that inimitable Colombian way, magic happened in an instant. And they said, sure, let's do it. And the head of Grupo Argos was at the lunch, and he said, well, we'll support that. And so that began what ended up being almost a five-year engagement as to try to use this river to tell the story of Colombia, because Colombia is the Magdalena, and the Magdalena is the country, and in fact, Colombia is the gift of the river. And at no point was I tempted, you know, to, you know, paddle the river from source to mouth, or even to travel its length by hitching rides on riverboats. You know, admirable as those achievements might have been. This was not to be a book about self. It wasn't to be a travel book in that sense. You know, the Spanish subtitle for the Colombian edition won't be River of Dreams. It'll be Historias de Colombia. It's really the voice of Colombia speaking through the river. And, you know, I always feel that, you know, when in doubt, an author should get out of the way and let the story speak. So in that sense, I spent 5 years, you know, visiting every corner of the Cuenca. And it was our mutual friend, Herman Ferro, who runs a glorious museum of the Magdalena in Onda, who really turned me on as we walked through the museum to the fundamental and obvious fact that the Magdalena is not just a river course, but it's a massive valley that has touched the entire history of the country. And that really dictated the itinerary by which I explored the region, both geographically, culturally, but even metaphysically, over the course of five different long trips to the Cuenca.
Yeah, I would say at some point, at some level, and it's exhaustive. It's not only a history book, and you know, you aren't the figure in the book. You are the vessel by which the book has been written, but it's also, you know, a 350 plus page homage to Colombia, but also to the Colombian people, because each segment and each insert is a story with a personality and a character, and you really pick up some interesting people along the way. One of those who you just mentioned, Herman Ferro Medina, who's been one of our greatest supporters here in Mompós. Uh-huh. I mean, I hope you're in touch with him continually about this book. And
oh, absolutely, you know, he wrote me the most, you know, probably the most poignant words in the book were spoken by Herman when he reflected on the fact that he was at the actual confluence of the Cauca and the Magdalena as he first heard word of the signing of the peace agreement. And he said he sort of immersed himself on this river that he loved so much. And he said rivers of tears fell as he realized that my son could grow up in a land at peace. It's the most beautiful passage perhaps in the entire book. But you know, Hector Abad, our good friend from Medellin, brilliant writer, he described the book as a love letter to the country, and in many ways it is that. But it's also kind of sociology by serendipity, in the sense that you know, one incredible Colombian passed me off to another incredible Colombian, and amongst them was my good friend Sandra Uribe, que es más paisa que cualquier paisa, you know, and she herself embodied every character, because there were so many people I met had to fight their way into the manuscript, if you know what I mean. And in that sense, each character in the book had to embody some element of the saga of modern Colombia. So, for example, Sandra exemplified what it meant to be a child of a scion of the elite, forced to flee abroad. I mean, her parents were nearly destroyed by bombs. The door of her house was blown in Medellin. At the age of 15, she realized she couldn't tell the sound of thunder from the sound of bombs. She goes off to Miami, where she's made to live with her grandmother, where at 15 she's made fun of because she comes from the city of Escobar by American high school students whose main social activity is the pursuit of drugs, with cocaine being their drug of choice. Sandra, of course, having grown up in Medellin, has never seen, let alone used, cocaine. And she then returned to Medellin, not simply to live there, but to be part of the rebirth of her city and the rebirth of her nation. And she introduced me to this fantastic journalist, Juan Betancourt. And I called him Juancito because I just found him such an endearing man. And he, of course, had begun life as a sports reporter, but of course, like everybody else, especially in the wake of the bombing of the Espectador headquarters in the newspaper in Bogota, he became part a war correspondent for 7 long years. And his passion in life, since he heard the stories of his father, of the Vapores and the David Arango had always been to travel the river from source to mouth. Mm-hmm. And after 7 years in the front lines of the war, he had his chance to do it. And he wrote a beautiful book called, I think it was Los Olvidados, the Forgotten Ones. But, and it's essentially, you know, he described his work, and he's typically Colombian. He was so generous. In the middle of vacation, when he could have been with his family, he agreed to join Sandra and I on this kind of madcap exploration of the Medio Magdalena. And in retrospect, it seemed almost preordained for the three of us to come together. But in the moment, it was kind of, you know, three people, total strangers to each other, who knew what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. But magic happened, as it always does in Colombia. But Juan described his own research that led to the writing of his book as being sort of sociology of serendipity. He would turn up in a village and simply wait, or on a bank of the river, and simply wait until he found someone who had something to say that the world needed to hear, which, as he knew as a great storyteller, is the essence of storytelling. And that's, in a sense, I didn't really set out to mimic his methodology, if you will, but in a way, that's what the book became, where, you know, we never knew who we were going to meet. And we literally were in this kind of wonderfully Colombian way, you know, passed off one person to the next. Each one had something very unique to share about their experiences. And then collectively, I think it's a fair representation of the harsh reality of Colombia over the last 50 years, but also of the great hopes of Colombia. I mean, when you write, you know, Hemingway said, you know, anyone who says who writing is easy is either a lousy writer or a liar. You know, books are hard, and I've written a lot of them, and you always have to have some passion. You have to have some sense of your motivation. And for me, with Colombia, that wasn't difficult. I just had the strongest sense that the dark cliches that circulate the world about this wonderful nation were so unjust, given the circumstances. I mean, let's step back for a moment. I mean, you know, here's a country that has indeed suffered 50 years of conflict, 220, some say 260,000 dead, 7 million displaced, you know, 100,000 missing, perhaps God knows how many kidnapped. And yet through all those years, the number of combatants in a nation of 50 million people never numbered somewhere, I would guess, between 200 and 300,000. So the vast majority of Colombians, by definition, were simply caught in the vice of war, innocent victims of a conflict beyond their control. And critically, that conflict would not have lasted a week had it not been for the flood of illicit money coming from the cocaine trade. I mean, I remind any audience that will listen that in the last year before the signing of the peace agreement, the FARC, who were down to perhaps 6,000 cadre, mostly teenagers in search of a meal, nevertheless made $600 million from extortion, with much of that coming from the cocaine trade. Well, you give me $600 million and the Brooklyn Boy Scouts, and I can wreak havoc in New York State. In other words, you know, I really do sincerely believe that from the very beginning, and I was living in Medellin at the very beginning. I was working, I had a post at the Medellin, El Jardín Botánico in Medellin in 1974 when the cartels were emerging. And from the very start, North Americans were complicitous in the trade. It was Vietnam vets who taught the Colombians how to fly. You know, my friend Antonio Dorado, this wonderful filmmaker from Cali, a professor at Valle as well, did a really good film called El Rey, The King, about the early days of the drug trade. And it really captures this unholy alliance between kind of low-life Colombian hustlers and Vietnam vets and gringos in Colombia in the early 70s in search of kind of easy living, beautiful women, cheap drugs, etc. The cartels may have emerged from the boardrooms and barrios of Medellin and Cali, but the entire trade was always driven by consumption. Mm-hmm. And I say to Americans in particular, how would you feel if Canada had patterns of drug consumption and laws that facilitated a black market trade, but a nation that did nothing to curb that trade in any serious way, such that 85 million Americans were forced to leave their homes? Well, that's what happened to Colombia. And yet the amazing thing is the strength of the Colombian people allowed them to endure that, not just endure that, but maintain their democracy, their civil society, green their cities, create millions of acres of national parks, seek restitution with indigenous people in a manner that, though flawed in places, was nevertheless unlike anything a nation state has managed to do. And I'm thinking, of course, of Virgilio Barco and Martin von Hildebrand's creation of the 162 resguardos in the Northwest Amazon in the 1980s, encoded in the 1991 Constitution in perpetuity in Colombia. No nation state's ever done that. And because of that, a whole new dream of culture has been reborn amongst the 57 ethnicities of the Colombian Amazon. So I think none of this is to absolve Colombians of agency or responsibility. I've heard Colombia described as La Tienda a la Esquina. I mean, there's this entrepreneurial zeal. And at some level, the paisas weren't about to let that trade slip through their fingers, right? And it is kind of an amazing achievement if you ignore the darker elements of the madness that even though the most powerful military force in the world was spending, even in the early days, up to $37 billion a year to try to stop the trade, the Medellin cartel was still putting 80 tons of cocaine into America every month, generating, some say, $70 million of profit a day. And in fact, accountants in Medellin were budgeting $1,000 a week just to purchase elastic bands. So this unholy trade, it's amazing that Colombia endured it, if you think about it. And it remains the thorn in the side of peace. And this is why there's so many of us are in favor of the legalization of all drugs. But most importantly, the carving off of coca from cocaine, so that people recognize that coca is to cocaine what potatoes are to vodka. And one of the fascinating things, Richard, you may not have heard, but you know, there's often been said that, you know, oh no, coca in terms of cultural context is a Peruvian, a southern Andean phenomena. We just took the plant and extracted cocaine and exploited it. Not so. Recent science, for the longest time, we thought that the original cultivated species of coca was Erythroxylum coca from the southern Andes. And based on a number of morphological traits, we thought that the coca of Colombia, Erythroxylum novogranitense, was derived from Peruvian coca. And that the coca of the Colombian Amazon, we do know, is a variety of the Peruvian strain that came up the river and was planted vegetatively. So the coca of the Northwest Amazon has nothing to do, well, is not the same as the coca of the mountains of the Sierra and of Cauca. But the fascinating thing, and that kind of history held for ever since we did those first studies in the 1970s. Interestingly, recent work using DNA analysis has shown without doubt that coca originated in two places from the same progenitor, the same wild species that is found along the entire cloud forest of the Andes, was reached out to by peoples of the southern Andes, but independently from peoples of Colombia, found the same wild species and domesticated it. So when you say today that coca was born in Colombia, it really was born in Colombia.
Wow, and so it's all new to me. This is definitely all new to me, and all new to my listeners. The problem of cocaine is something that you deal with a great deal in the book, and have dealt with in articles and so on, and of course the Magdalena River. You know, we know here, for example, if there's a boat on the river in Monbos after 6 p.m., it's probably transporting something illicit because they're not allowed on the rivers, and yet it still occurs. The money is too much, as you say. There's just too much money. But when I read your book, and I reread it as well, and I think, you know, you go, and you've mentioned all of these things. I mean, you get sort of passed around from person to person, from character to character. You go from people of the elite, and you go to, you know, let's say more ordinary people. So you've got a cross-section of who's there.
But it kind of, to me, reinforces the rural-urban divide and the have-have-nots in Colombia. And you just do discuss the need for land reform, and you do discuss that it happened somewhat in Bolivia and somewhat in Peru back in the, let's say, 60s and 70s. And it's the first thing on the peace accords. It's the first thing discussed, the agrarian reform. Are we any closer in your mind as a long-term visitor, as a person who knows Colombia inside and out, are we any closer to seeing something of that nature?
Well, you know, land reform doesn't mean expropriation, which is how it is often described by those who resist it. It's really about fairness and justice. And the whole situation, land tenure in Colombia, is so complicated because during the conflict, the federal state was not even present in much of the country, and extortion occurred. Even in the process of reconciliation, individuals who had to flee their land come back and find that their land, even with the best of intentions, has been given to another campesino who was desperate to need it because they had been. And I've seen that on the ground in many, many places. I think in general, and this is a kind of a parallel to what's going on in the United States that's been revealed in the COVID crisis, is that, you know, the thing that drives unrest, the thing that drives, that erodes the well-being of countries is fundamental notions of justice and fairness. You know, I say that not as someone from the left. My politics are very much down the middle. But if you look at the American situation, for example, in the wake of COVID, the whole Trump cohort, if you will, are individuals who, for the most part, feel that they've been left out. You know, if you look back in American history, coming out of World War II, 4% of the world's population generated half the world's economy, built 90% of the world's automobiles. And Europe was in ashes, as was Japan and Asia. And that abundance, that monopoly, if you will, allowed for a truce between labor and capital. It gave us a weekend, gave us a middle class, whereby a man of limited education could look forward to buying a house, buying a car, looking forward to putting his kids through public school. And yet, not that the 1950s were an ideal time in America, certainly if you're a person of color or gay or a woman. But the point is, in economic terms, the culture was more reminiscent of Denmark today than it was of America today. You know, the income of a CEO would be 20 times that of a staff member. Marginal tax rates were 91%. Not that people paid 91%, but the message was there that everybody contributes. Well, today the average CEO would have an income perhaps 500 times that of a white-collar worker. You know, the top 1% controls $1 trillion of assets. The bottom half have more debt than assets. The top richest 3 Americans control more wealth than the lower poorest 160 million. And so this chasm between those who have and those who have not is something that no democracy in the long term can tolerate or endure if it is to remain democratic. And I think that in Colombia, you know, that at the end of the day, the discrepancies between those who have and those who have not have to be addressed. And the country, frankly, is wealthy enough to do that. I mean, I think one of the real tragedies is the timing with which the peace accord began to unravel. If you think about it, for example, if President Santos had not been precluded from continuing in office for, say, a second term, things might have been very different. But if you think of what happened, I mean, it's interesting. In 2006, when, to his enormous credit, Álvaro Uribe demilitarized the paramilitaries. Now, of course, he didn't. You know, he didn't drive them off the scene. Maybe he just put them underground. But as an open, marauding force, they were neutered and neutralized. And to do that, he had to offer incredibly lenient terms, which offended so many people on the left. But of course, the Paracos were not about to simply put down their arms and walk into a prison cell. And by the same token, when President Santos was negotiating with the FARC, and again, I go back to that statistic, as long as you're making $600 million, given the topography and geography of Colombia, a handful of people with those kind of resources can be a thorn in the side of the state forever, right? So again, President Santos had to offer terms that would guarantee that the FARC would walk out of the forest and into the civil society, which he attempted to do. He was pilloried for that, even though it was really analogous just to what Uribe had done in 2006. And then the peace agreement itself, people around the world don't realize how complex it is. You know, I mean, it's got hundreds of clauses. The implementation of it was going to be $45 billion. And then suddenly, because of the referendum, I mean, think what might have happened if, you know, President Santos didn't have to put the vote to a referendum. And what he did in pushing the treaty through Congress was completely illegal. But because he, I think, in a really gracious way, had put it to a referendum, and the referendum so narrowly failed, right, by hundreds of votes only, then people on the right felt offended when he pushed it through, which was a legal thing to do. Mm-hmm. But then, because of Colombia's constitution, and he wasn't able to run again, you saw Iván Duque be able to split a divided field with the support of Álvaro Uribe, and become president on a platform that, in a sense, promised not only, you know, if not to completely drop the agreement, but certainly to dismantle key elements of it, or at least not to enthusiastically embrace it. Even though, by the way, homicide rates dropped within the first year of peace to levels not seen since 1975. Then, from what I hear from my Colombian friends, journalists in particular, all these vast areas had been occupied by the FARC. The federal state did not inhabit them quickly enough. And into that void came all the opportunists, the disgruntled FARC, the dissident FARC, the ELN, the bandidos, the carteles, whatever. And the treaty promised to open up the society. So civil society lifted its head and once again got it chopped off with all these assassinations. And so that puts out this terrible image to the world. And at the same time, suddenly oil prices plummet. And Colombia's dealing with the greatest humanitarian crisis in the history of Latin America. 1.8 million Venezuelans, who, by the way, aren't being put into cages as the Americans have been putting innocent mothers and children on their border through the explicit policy of denial. The Colombians have housed, fed, given medical care and education to 1.8 million people. This is a humanitarian gesture that ought to be heralded around the world, and yet you never hear a word about it. So in this sense, I don't think there's anyone particularly to blame, but clearly the peace process is precarious. And what keeps it precarious, above all, is cocaine. Yeah. You know, as long as you have that kind of money. You know, when we were in a small town of San Diego, Diana Ocampo is a really powerful female in the book, and the story of her family is just heartbreaking. But she took us to a little rock on their farm. Their farm had been totally destroyed because it was occupied by both the paramilitaries and the FARC in the long battles around that small little town of San Diego on the Cauca-Huila border. And she took us to a stone where every night the family would gather to ask themselves, should we be planting coca? They were the only family that didn't. And they knew that if they did, their financial problems would be over. But the stepfather, Don Jose, just said, which one of you wants to be the first to die? And as it turns out, they were the only family not to suffer death. But at the same time, when I asked them, they said that to grow cane and make panela, the returns for that were 1/1000th less than what you can get for coca leaves. So, you know, cosechando coca, la cosecha de coca, vale a lo menos, at least 1,000 times more probably than any other crop. So in those circumstances, you know, people have no options really. And that's one of the reasons so many people are advocating the creation of a legal nutraceutical market for the coca leaf, so that we can actually have a product which will surpass coffee in terms of its value, because it is a much better stimulant. And don't forget that we've done the nutritional studies of coca, and it turns out to be full of vitamins, more calcium than any other plant ever studied, enzymes that enhance the body's ability to digest carbohydrate at high elevation, 4,000 years of ritual and daily use with not one sign of toxicity or addiction in all the pre-Columbian peoples of the Andes and the Amazon, and including the peoples today. So to compare coca with cocaine is like comparing the luscious fruit of a peach with the dangerous cyanogenic prussic acid found within the pit of a peach. And so, you know, there's only one ultimate solution, and this should be the gift of the world to Colombia, which is the legalization, and let people deal with the consequences of it. And above all, let those in the consuming nations for once take some responsibility for a dynamic that has brought agony to one of America's great shining democracies, which is Colombia. And you know, once you can get stability in the economy and in the countryside, then people in a new Colombia will have the confidence to address issues of economic inequity, such that no young person will ever be tempted to take up arms simply to get three meals a day, or to pursue a kind of a antiquated, completely debunked and exposed ideology of Marxist materialism that no nation has ever benefited from.
I'm completely on board with you there, and of course I think we both stand on the same side of the page when it comes to fumigation, aerial fumigation, which is likely to return under Duque, I think.
You know, I asked a simple question, you know, in the book. Why on earth should Colombian people, who did not begin this problem, who are not the engine driving the trade, why should they for one moment accept any potential danger to their richest national resource, which of course is the biodiversity, the plants and the animals of the landscape, the fish of the rivers? Why should they accept any risk to that, let alone to the health of their own children, to satisfy the political needs of a nation whose own people are so delusional and so miserable that they seek escape in a drug that's best used as a topical anesthetic to numb the senses so you can pull a tooth? You know, let America and let anyone who uses this foul drug come to terms with it. Now, look, there's another obvious thing. I mean, I say that because I'm one who's always trying to break off coca from cocaine. Mm. But the bottom line is that there's no such thing as good and bad drugs. There are good and bad ways of using drugs. The truth is that cocaine hydrochloride remains our most effective topical anesthetic for nose, throat, and ear surgery. It also is true that one is completely capable of having a reasonably decent relationship with recreational cocaine, one assumes. I know that's for people to make that decision themselves. But all we know, and I'm not one of those people who has any interest in recreational cocaine, but the point is, what we do know without doubt is that the consequences shown of the illicit trade are infinitely more dangerous, corrosive, and debilitating than any imagined consequences of a policy of complete legalization. Mm-hmm. The truth is, if you legalize drugs tomorrow, cocaine in particular, consumption would not go up, because people are never motivated to use or not use illicit drugs by their legal status. You'll never meet anyone who does it who cares less, right? And if I want to get cocaine, sadly, I can get cocaine in the street corner of any capital city of anywhere in the world. That's how effective the distribution networks are. are. My reason not to do it has nothing to do with the illicit nature of cocaine. It's because I know that the use of cocaine is not a good thing to do over time, at least for me. So again, I think that the dangers of legalization are always overwrought, over exaggerated. In fact, every country that's legalized drugs has seen consumption drop, because a lot of what drives the whole energy of the trade is a profit motive. I'll tell you one quick story, Richard. When I came back from Colombia in 1975, having done this long study of coca for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, my close friend Tim Plowman, who led the research, told me there was a job available at the USDA that he wanted me to apply for. But then he said if I took the job, he'd kill me. Well, I thought, that's interesting. So I go out to the USDA, and I go to this office, and I find this guy who clearly is not USDA. He's DEA, right? First thing I notice about him, he's a drug addict. I can't get into the room for the cigarette smoke. Then I see that his walls are covered by seized paraphernalia. It's like going to the office of an anti-pornographer and having to wallpaper pornography. And then I'm looking at this guy. Remember, this is 1975, so the cartel thing is just beginning. He's got gold chains around his neck. He's got gold nuggets on his wristwatch band. He's got a big butterfly collar that reveals a hairy chest. You can't make this stuff up. And it turns out that what he wanted me to do, all they had concluded from our research, which had traced the entire history of the sacred plant, the divine leaf of immortality, that had shown for the first time how nutritious it was and how critical it was to the nutritional regime and to the ritual life of the peoples of South America. All he had distilled was that Tim and I were good at finding coca fields. And he wanted me to go back into the coca plantations, secure the pests, the biological pests, bring them back that they could be mutated or bred to be more pernicious. And then I was to take them back and reintroduce them to kill more coca plants. And I'm looking at this guy and I'm thinking, I can't believe you. And then I look at him, I think, Jesus, where have I met you before? And I suddenly realized that I hadn't literally met him before, but I had met him 1,000 times because he was the Medellin cartel. His energy, his motivations, his interest in the drug were exactly their interests. You know, he was a beneficiary of if Escobar was making, you know, $70 million a day, as they said, and no one knows if he really made that much money. This guy was no chump. I mean, he was a beneficiary of the $60 billion the Americans were spending in the war on drugs. Neither party had the slightest interest in the war on drugs ending. This was a gravy train, and every single agency of the U.S. government, as the Washington Post would later reveal, got a piece of that bureaucratic pie. The point is the two people fighting this, the DEA and the war on drugs fanatics and the cartels, they love each other. I mean, they are absolutely simpatico, because the last thing the cartels want is legalization, and the last thing the agents want is legalization. Everybody would be out of work, right? So that's a big con of the war on drugs.
I think it's ridiculous. I've covered this on a couple of podcasts prior to that, this one, of course. We've long known this. It's the truth. Those of us who are, let's say, Colombianists or been here a long time, we've long known this and seen this. And of course, that experience and that anecdote is fantastic, because it really shows it from a personal perspective. Where have I met this guy? But actually, I've met him in every other way. I wonder, let's just as we wind this down, unfortunately, but I think I could get you to talk for hours and hours and hours. Just to go back to the book a little bit, because there's something very personal in it for me. And it's not just the Mompos section. And you knowing a few more of my personal friends, you talk about Samuel Marmol Abundio, the cumbia singer. He actually played at my wedding, and his son is teaching me how to play drums at the moment. And you talk with the Cabrales family, who are pretty much neighbors from mine too. So this is, again, this brings it close. But actually, the thing that really brings it home is that you make a comparison with the River Magdalena with the River Thames, and you make a comparison of what would happen when it's cleaned up. And for me, this is very personal. I've just submitted and had it accepted, my doctoral thesis here, and I make comparisons between London's King's Cross railway station and Bogota's Sabana station and the area and a regeneration, but not gentrification. And so I see the same balance that was made. And so for me, that's very personal. And you talk about rebirth, redemption, the symbol of patrimony and pride. And your friend Sandra also mentions it on later on. This really could be a rebirth, a regeneration, the river.
I mean, there's so many things you brought up there, Richard. I mean, first of all, before we refer to the Thames, let's think of the Mississippi. You know, I mean, just as the Mississippi was a corridor of commerce, the Magdalena is a corridor of commerce, but also a fountain of culture. You know, the repository of and the source of Colombian music and poetry and prayer and literature. You know, every single musician, including Obundio, that we met in both Mompós and El Banco, the center of Tambora, but also, you know, major centers of cumbia, always found a way, and up to and including the great international star Carlos Vivas, who you know, Carlos said to me, you know, all our rhythms derive from cumbia, but cumbia comes from the river, and the music is in the river. And this was a sentiment that was echoed by all these extraordinary musicians that we met, you know, in the Medio Magdalena and in the Bajo Magdalena. But, you know, the comparison to the River Thames is that if there's one thing we've seen in COVID is that was not in that Rolling Stone piece, but it sent a message that we're all biological beings on a living planet. And we saw the extraordinary regenerative powers of the earth, you know, within weeks of the global shutdown. You know, you saw wild boar in the streets of Barcelona, flamingos in the wetlands of Mumbai, cities like Karachi and Kathmandu and Delhi suddenly seeing the white peaks of the Himalaya scoring the northern horizon for the first time in generations, the canals of Venice in Medellin, the Rio Medellin suddenly looking like a trout stream. You know, the earth is so remarkably resilient. Even if you think the Rio Bogota, which leaves, of course, the capital, essentially a dead river. But even by the time it simply tumbles less than 50 kilometers to Girardot, it is biologically beginning to recover. You know, in 1967, the Natural History Museum in London declared the Thames a totally dead river. I mean, there was no oxygen in it. There was not the possibility of organic life. Well, today there's 125 species of fish in the River Thames. The Hudson River outside of New York was so polluted that people used to quip that you could tell what kind of car was being made in the Tarrytown GM factory on the banks of the river by the color of the river, because you knew what the paint color was. Well, today there remains a problem of heavy metals, thanks to the grace of General Electric. But at the same time, people can picnic along the river. You can swim in the river. It will be another century before you can safely eat the fish of the river. But that said, the fish have returned, and it's one of the richest fisheries on the eastern shores of North America at the moment. I mean, humpback whales have been seen from the Midtown Manhattan at the mouth of the Hudson. Inconceivable a short couple of generations ago. So rivers have this amazing ability. And compared to the status of the River Thames or the Hudson River at their low point, the Magdalena remains a bountiful river. And if you could simply clean up the Rio Bogota, which anyone who's been down to the confluence in Girardot, I mean, you literally see this black slurry of sludge coming into the Magdalena, you know, it would not take a lot to do that. And I think the way to do it is not as a kind of environmental campaign invoking more federal regulations that, as we know, no one follows anywhere, let alone in Colombia. But we should turn the whole thing into a gesture of patrimony. And this brings us back to Mompós. You know, one of the things that Enrique, your neighbor, who's a passionate lover of Simón Bolívar, and he was one of the greatest informants or friends that we met on the long series of journeys. He became my tutor as to the wonder of who these men were. And this very unusual birth of the Colombian nation, of Gran Colombia, the only nation that was born in a dream of natural history, that you know, it was the journeys of Humboldt that brought this nation alive. And Bolivar literally had the journals of Humboldt in his saddlebags as he marched his armies in that extraordinary war of liberation. He, you know, Humboldt used notions, the universe of nature, the power of nature. And in many ways, for Humboldt, he was speaking in metaphor. But in this unbelievably interesting way, the liberator, Simón Bolívar, actually took him literally, seriously. And he envisioned a nation built on that. I mean, there are unbelievably strict laws against deforestation. He arranged for millions of trees to be planted in Bolivia. He recognized the challenge of the Medio Magdalena long before most people. In other words, Colombia, you can absolutely argue, as I do in the book, was in good measure, if it was born of resistance and blood and revolution, it was conceived from the start in a vision of its natural bounty. So in that sense, as Sandra points out in the conversation we had with Enrique, we need to turn around the protection of nature, not to be the imposition of laws and regulations from a distant capital. And Lord knows, in Colombia, it's always been easy to ignore any rules that come down from the capital. We have to turn this into an issue of patriotism such that people understand that if you really understand the genesis of the nation and you love the essence of Colombia, as most Colombians do, a deeply patriotic people, then those who violate nature are committing a form of treason. And those who protect nature are the ultimate patriots. And in that sense, if we turn the cleaning up of the Rio Magdalena, not from an environmental battle, but as a symbol of national pride and patriotism, of patrimony. Because the Magdalena is Colombia, and Colombia is a gift of the river. And so when the Mamos speak as they do, in full sentences and full paragraphs, that the blood in our bodies is no different than the water in the river itself, they're not speaking in metaphor. It's quite true. We are all part of the hydrological cycle. When we die, our blood, which is a majority of our body's weight, will slip into the soil and flow to the sea as effortlessly as the Magdalena runs to Boca de Ceniza. You know, and so when the Mamos speak about making ritual payments at the mouth of the river, and they tell that in the early days, their ancestors actually made pilgrimages up the entire length of the river to the Macizo Colombiano to make offerings in La Laguna de la Magdalena, the origin, point of origin of the river, and that they would stop along the way and measuring the nature of the relationship of a people to the river as a sign of their civilization. That's a wonderful image to think of for a new Colombia. You know, I mean, I think in the end, what I'm trying to do with this book is the thing that people don't appreciate around the world, even within Colombia, is that think of the consequences of two generations of young kids being taught that their country is a failed state, a pariah nation. You know, a good friend of mine, Carolina Barco, who was the external affairs minister daughter of a president, of course, Virgilio Barco, who did so many incredible things. She was ambassador to Washington, D.C. at the time. She goes to Dulles Airport, and just for the sin of possessing a Colombian passport, she was strip-searched. And when she presented her diplomatic privileges, they dismissed them with obscenities, as if bark from the mouth of dogs. Now, if that happens to the ambassador to the United States, how do young Canadians, Colombian students feel? How are they treated? So the psychological impact is significant. And the greatest enemy of the peace process is cynicism, negativity, and despair. And so the book is, yes, it reveals with great empathy what Colombia went through, but it makes a much larger point that that's not Colombia, that my Colombia is, like I always say, you know, a place of colores y cariño, where the people have endured 50 years of war precisely because of their character, which is informed by a deep love of the nation and by a powerful spirit of place, rooted in that landscape that only Colombians understand. And so the more we can hold a mirror to all that is beautiful and wonderful in Colombia without being naive or insulting in our naivete or dismissive of the agonies in our vision of hope that people have endured, the more we can hold up to the country a vision of what it is and what therefore what it can be and what it has been from its inception during the revolutionary era, the more chance we will have that people will find the confidence to embrace peace. And that's what it takes. You know, war is easy. Peace is hard. But with it come limitless possibilities.
Well, I can think of no better way than to end on that comment and colores y cariño. So I'd like to take this moment to say, everybody out there, buy River of Dreams, Magdalena, River of Dreams, Wade Davis's most recent book. And it has been an absolute honor and a pleasure to have you and to hear your thoughts and anecdotes here on the Columbia Calling podcast. Hopefully our paths cross at some point, somewhere, probably here in Colombia, potentially in Montbos, hopefully. Let me just say thank you so much to Wade Davis for his time and his generosity with his anecdotes and stories.
Thank you very much, Richard. Nos vemos en Montpost.
Okay.
And a special message from our sponsors this week, calling all U.S. citizens. Your vote counts. Even if you have never lived in the U.S. or haven't lived there recently, go to votefromabroad.org. That's votefromabroad.org today to request your ballot. Votes received from abroad make the difference in elections every year. If you have voting-related questions, you can use the red chat box on votefromabroad.org and someone will get back to you within a few hours. Don't delay. 15 states have already passed their registration deadlines. See if you are still eligible to register and request your ballot today. That's from votefromabroad.org. Thank you again.